one, yeah.
Yes. I think you do.
So item number 16, mineral prospecting. This is a briefing and public input. So and then we have the two panels that will be coming forward. So on that, Jeff, I'll turn it over to you, sir.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the commission, Director Storr and Deputy Director Windrope, consuming food behind you. My name is Jeff Davis. I am your assistant director, and I oversee the habitat program here at the department. And I'll introduce my teammates here in a minute, but I wanted to maybe put a little context and share maybe a little bit of my thoughts with you this morning as we dive into this really important topic area. With that, I think it's fair to say that the folks behind me that are involved in this topic area are good people. There's a lot of passion around it for a whole host of valuable reasons. And in my experience, which is 17 years on this topic area, every single one of these folks cares about fish. I haven't heard anyone say they don't care about fish. So that's good news, I think, stepping into that. It gives us some hope for some successful outcomes here. I do want to say that you received some comment letters from tribes, I don't think we have a tribal representative here this morning, but I wanted to let you know that we will be reaching out to the tribes to have some further conversations to make sure that their perspective is brought forward to you. I also want to thank you for the opportunity for this briefing, because I think that we're not doing our business well if we're not reflecting on what the current system is and how effective it is and whether or not something needs to change. So I appreciate that. And I also, to the folks behind me, I want to thank them for the time and energy that they put in to come and bring their perspectives and information to you as well, so that you have as much clarity as you need in order to give us a sense of direction moving forward on this. Also wanting to keep our presentation clear and concise and abbreviated to the best of our ability. It's a balancing act with how complex the issue is and how to give you the right type of information without putting you to sleep or taking up other valuable folks' times that on the other panels. So we'll be clear, concise, as energetic as humanly possible. And with that, I'd like to introduce Randy Thurston at the end of the table there. She's our Protection Division Manager, oversees the HPA program as well as our oil spill team. And next to her is Teresa Scott. She is an amazing talent and helps us dig into some of these HPA-related issues, doing some research behind the scenes there to help us make sure that we're on the right track and building some strategic pathways forward to inform you all. And next to me is Pat Chapman. He is the Habitat Program historian, and we will not let him retire until we can figure out how to download his brain. But Pat oversees our HPA section, and really that's a critical connection point with our regional staff, but also the applicants that come through the door to do hydraulic project approvals. So with that, I will toss it to Pat, and we'll get this underway.
Excuse me, Jeff. Yeah.
So whoever is responsible for this comparison table, thank you. And I would just point it out to my fellow commissioners, if you haven't seen it, there is a table that staff has put together comparing our rigs across the other three states, Oregon, Idaho, and California, and it's very valuable information. So thank you, staff.
That was Teresa.
Thank you.
Good morning, commissioners and Mr. Chair. We wanted to set the stage for the panel discussion to have just a brief introduction to suction dredging so that everyone's on the same page, at least from our perspective. And so we're going to do a few things this morning. Start out with a description of a dredge so everyone is sure of what we're talking about, of a typical dredge. Then I'll review the brief regulatory history of what we've done for mineral prospecting, including suction dredging. I'll go over the four main impacts that are potential for suction dredging and how we deal with those through our regulations. And then Teresa will review the comparison of regulations through other states compared with Washington. So here's a typical dredge, suction dredge. And some people call them recreational dredges. It really doesn't matter whether they're recreational or doing it commercially. Recreational kind of refers to the size of the dredge. And typically what you see is a machine that's operated in stream, and it typically floats on pontoons. It can be embedded or put on stilts, so stationary in the stream. But it operates with a simple gas-powered pump that pumps water in through an intake hose, taking water from the stream that has hopefully a fish screen on it so fish aren't sucked into the equipment. It discharges that water under high pressure into this suction hose somewhere in the hose that creates a suction, Venturi effect, that allows the diver, which is here, to suck up the materials on the bottom of the stream. That goes through the hose, dumps into the sluice box or riffle box of various sizes, and the tailings, the aggregate that doesn't have the gold, hopefully is discharged out the end, and if everything is done right, the gold is preserved into the sluice box, which then they separate out later, generally with a pan. In this case, there's an air supply that's provided to the diver so they can stay underwater as long as they need to, or the gas runs out. This generated off of the pump. So the tailings are discharged right below the dredge, and they'll move, depending on how fast they're moving, they'll move upstream or they'll operate in a hole that is excavated there. This equipment roughly costs anywhere from $3,500 to $6,000, a current price for new equipment, and it's generally operated by a single person, although there may be an assistant on the shore making sure it's gassed up and it's not plugged up, that sort of thing. Okay, so that's a dredge. The history of the department's regulation goes way back, and I mentioned to Jeff this morning that on March 1st, designates the 75th anniversary of the governor signing the hydraulic code. So mineral prospecting, obviously you can see, affects the better flow of state water, so it is a hydraulic project the department regulates. Prior to 1980, the Department of Game and Department of Fisheries regulated prospecting activities through individual permits. But around 1980, interest in gold mining became a lot higher because the price of gold skyrocketed, if you remember back then. And the departments decided to produce a pamphlet, HPA, to streamline the permitting requirements. In those pamphlets, even though dredging was mentioned, the only things authorized under the pamphlet were panning and sluicing and then later mini high banking. So if somebody wanted to dredge or use some other types of equipment, they had to get an individual HPA, even though the pamphlet was there. In 1997, after a number of things happened, the pamphlet originally had been modified several times. The legislature passed a law that required the department to engage in rulemaking for small-scale mineral prospecting and publish those rules in a pamphlet. And that pamphlet came out in 1999. It covered probably 90% of the types of prospecting that prospectors are interested, anywhere from panning to sluicing to dredging to high banking. All that was included in the pamphlet, with the possibility of exceptions to the pamphlet through an individual permit if someone needed to do that. Also in that pamphlet was the first time we had rules for mineral prospecting. Prior to that, the regulation was just based on the department's input through an individual permit. So we went along for a number of years, and then in 2009, upon a petition of the prospectors to the commission directed us to go through rulemaking again. And we did that with the assistance of a stakeholder group composed of all kinds of folks, prospectors, environmental interest, other agencies, and we came up with new rules for that and had different timing, some other changes to the existing pamphlet. That pamphlet has been modified a couple times, and then our current pamphlet was published in 2015 after the 2014 rulemaking that we did with the commission. And the big thing there was we included ocean beach prospecting under the pamphlet. We had a few modifications to work windows. So let's talk about the main impacts and how we deal with those for suction dredging. And what I will say is what I'm going to talk about is things that we considered and regulate through the pamphlet, but biologists, when they deal with individual permits, both for suction dredging and other aspects of prospecting, consider these same things. So I may bounce back and forth and call it suction dredges versus prospecting. It's really all the same thing. We would consider it both for dredging and the others. So it's clear that I think everyone would agree that unregulated prospecting and suction dredging we'd have problems with. So that's why we do have the rules and we have the pamphlet, because there are impacts to fish life. There are four main impacts and methods that we look at. So the first would be that dredging could result in impacts and excavation on fish reds and incubating fish in the gravel, or if done incorrectly different times a year, could suck in small fish into the equipment and damage them. So we do a number of things to combat that. One is probably our biggest tool is restriction of the times of years that prospectors can work in water. And so we try and regulate them out of times when eggs, particularly salmonids, are incubating in the gravel, either eggs or fry before they emerge. So we restrict them from those times a year. There's also a possibility that, you know, since we have wide-ranging timings and we don't do individual site review under the pamphlet, that we may have fish coming earlier or later than we anticipated. In the rules, we say if you happen to see fish spawning or you run into eggs in a gravel pit that they're working, they need to move away if they happen to find those. We also limit the size of the equipment that prospectors can use. So you hear a 4-inch, 5-inch. That references, for suction dredging, that references the size of the terminal end of the suction nozzle where they're sucking the materials in. And by limiting the size, we limit how fast they can work and how much impact they can have on the stream. So even if there were a problem, they'd be limited to how much stream they could deal with. Let me close that. And then finally, because there may be small fish, which are weaker swimmers, in the water column when they're working, we require that this suction intake or the pump intake is screened to prevent fish being sucked in the equipment and being chewed up and destroyed that way. So that's how we deal with excavation and entrainment. Another potential impact is alterations of the channel composition and morphology, because suction dredging, by definition, is changing the bed. They're moving materials, they're sucking materials in the equipment. So, again, what we do there was you limit the size of the equipment they can use. Yes, they can suck up the bed, but by having smaller equipment, they can't do as much as, say, a 12-inch dredge would do that you see in some of the TV shows that are popular now. And that small equipment, again, is operated by a single person, so we don't have armies of people out there working on one site. If they make holes, which they do as they're suction dredging, they're required to fill those in, so if the water lowers down, fish aren't stranded by those holes that are excavated. And you may have seen some of the historical pictures of water cannons where the old-timers were using high pressure to just destroy hillsides. We prevent that. The only time we allow some pressurized water is if they're crevicing or if they're redistributing the tailings that they've produced. And then finally, there are important habitat features in the stream that we prevent folks from moving, or if they do move, they have to replace, such as embedded wood. They can't excavate in the toe of the bank and cause erosion to go into the stream. There could also be some water quality degradation issues. And mainly suction dredging in particular deals with remobilization of what's already in the stream. And so we can't do anything about what's already in the stream, but we can deal with how that's impacted. So one of the things that you see in this graphic, a dredge will create some sediment discharge out of the sluice box and some turbidity. So we limit the distance that equipment can operate close to each other so we don't compound the impact of that material moving downstream and it just doubles and triples. So we prevent that. Because they're dealing with motorized equipment, obviously there's fueling issues. We require that fuel be stored upland and that they follow best management practices to do that. If there's a spill, they have to stop work and make sure there's not a fish kill, that sort of thing. And then, once again, prevent disturbance of key habitat features like we had in the previous slide. And finally, the last one is changing of the flow patterns of the stream or possibly dewatering a stream. Depends on the size of the stream, obviously, and the equipment that they're using. You know, in these pictures here, you're not going to dewater the stream with this equipment, but in smaller situations, you could. We, to avoid obstruction of passage of fish, we avoid, with our work windows, times when fish would want to be migrating for spawning. So we avoid those spawning windows. Even if there are fish that want to move, even if they're not spawning, but they want to move up and downstream, we require prospectors to limit their work during daylight hours so that fish can migrate during night, even if the stream is blocked during the day. And finally, while this doesn't happen very often with prospecting, but in smaller streams, they may have to temporarily dam up the stream. We require that they dam up no more than 50% of that width of the stream so that fish can move around if they need to. And before they leave, they have to remove that dam structure. Okay, Teresa.
Great. So let's switch gears for a minute and look at how other neighboring states regulate suction dredging. First off, California legislature prohibited suction dredging in 2009, and that prohibition remains in place today. That legislation also required California Department of Fish and Wildlife to revise their suction dredge permit rules, which they have done in 2012 and again in 2016. And the legislation also required state water quality rules to be developed. And those rules are still under development. Will take at least another year before the water quality permits are available. In Oregon, suction dredging ban went into effect in 2016, and that was implemented by limiting permits in essential salmonid habitat and prohibiting suction dredging in state scenic waterways. Oregon legislation last year prohibited suction dredging in essential salmon habitat starting this year in 2018. But suction dredging can occur, for example, upstream of salmonid habitat. State water quality permits are required in Oregon for most mineral prospecting equipment there. In Idaho has a state permit that limits suction dredging time and locations, but the distinguishing feature of Idaho's regulatory scheme is that Federal Environmental Protection Agency issues water quality permits for suction dredging. EPA, so Idaho has a lot of public land, like a huge proportion of public land. And so most of the suction dredging that occurs is on public land. Public land managers then, federal land managers, are consulting with ESA fish managers and incrementally increasing the areas that are open to suction dredging but under limited number of permits and other provisions. Oh, I have to do my own? So for a second, we look at similarities among the states. All four states specify the times and locations where dredges can operate and limit mining to periods that are least likely to impact fish spawning and egg incubation. All four states require prospectors to avoid reds, spawning fish, and freshwater shellfish. All states require screening on water pump intakes, Pat already mentioned. All four have restrictions that limit the volume of material processed. So Pat talked about nozzle size here. Other states use horsepower or dimensions of the sluice are another way to limit the amount of material that can be processed. All states have similar provisions with respect to the habitat features and vegetation, for example, prohibiting disturbance of embedded large wood and requiring prospectors to level their piles of processed material. And all four states have similar best management practices or operating provisions in their regulations and the fueling requirements, Pat also mentioned. And differences among states, California and Oregon require 500 feet between active suction dredging, whereas Washington requires 200 feet of separation, and Idaho state law requires 100 feet of separation, although Idaho's water quality permit requires 800 feet of separation. California state laws and rules allow California Department of Fish and Wildlife to establish time and area restrictions based on 68 different species of fish, shellfish, snails, amphibians, and birds. Oregon prohibits removal or disturbance of vegetation within 100 yards of the wetted waterway. The other states have those restrictions but don't specify necessarily a distance. Oregon and Idaho require a water quality permit before the state suction dredging permit can be issued. Rules adopted in California are similar, but it will be at least another year before the water quality permit itself is available. Washington pamphlet rules allow mineral spot prospecting to occur. Oh, yeah.
Well, my question, thank you. I'll be very brief, but my question was on the point you were just saying and the previous point. When you speak about Oregon, California, Idaho, and you speak about issuing a permit, is that some type of a blanket permit, or does each prospector have to go and get those permits individually from the regulatory body?
Well, that's exactly my next point. Thank you for asking. Let me answer that question. Washington has the pamphlet. We've heard about the pamphlet rules, and therefore most people don't have to have submit an individual application. The other states require suction dredgers to get a permit annually. So they apply and get a permit annually. And all three of those states also require some sort of after-season reporting before they can get the next year's permit. So that was really all I had. Questions about?
I do want to clarify that if mineral prospectors are proposing to do something that doesn't fall within the specifications of Golden Fish pamphlet, they do apply for an individual HPA.
I know we're behind, but
I
want to ask just a quick question about the other states' practices. You say you apply, prospectors have to apply for a permit. Are those what type of review process is it? Is it can you describe a little bit about what the process is? Is it something more than just coming to WDFW and going up and requesting a permit? Is there kind of more information that's provided?
Well, I think as in Washington with individual HPAs, there's a range of the amount of individual review permit gets based on where it's located and all kinds of things. My sense is, for example, in Idaho, the state suction dredging permit and provisions are really of less importance than the water quality permit. The water quality permit really has a lot more provisions and restrictions. And so it's the individual water quality permit that has the sort of tooth in Idaho. really can't speak to the other states. California, of course, has been in a moratorium since 2009. They have a permit program within their regulations, waiting for a time when those might be issued. And I know that California has a certain kind of situation where they would do more focused on the ground inspections before they issue a permit. I don't really know what those conditions are. We can get some more information to you.
No, that's fine. I'm just kind of curious.
Yeah, yeah.
So, Jeff, you're ready for questions from us now?
Yeah.
Any, open it up for other questions to the panel or to staff. Okay. Thanks, guys. We'll see you in a bit. So here are the rules of engagement for the next part. We have two panels, and we will start with the small-scale miners. What?
Let's do Trout.
Oh, they're first?
First, yeah.
Okay. Sorry about that. Then we will start with the Trout Unlimited panel first, and I guess I'll call you up. You have 20 minutes from when you get up here, so how you divide that, and the miners will have 20 minutes as well.
Do we have slides?
Nothing.
Crystal has it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So Bill, let me read these off as you come up. Bill Clark, Crystal Elliott, Pat Hessel Gesser, John McMillan, Dr. Leo Bodensteiner, and John Bornson, please. To remind you of Monday afternoons, sitting around the faculty meetings. This is, I still, it gives me the same heartburn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, commissioners, for having us today. We really appreciate the opportunity.
Let me just make sure that the clock's running.
I'm going to apologize in advance. We were told we had 30 minutes.
Oh.
So we've got 20, and we'll talk really fast.
Clock running? Go.
Thank you very much for having us here today for this important conversation. I'm Crystal Elliott. I'm the Washington State Habitat Director for Trout Unlimited. I live in Okanagan County, and I've been working on this issue for several years. I'm going to start with an overview of TU's perspective on this issue, and then I'm going to turn it over to our panelists who are going to provide in-depth briefings on our priority topics. And I'd also like to begin by saying that we represent a very small group of a very large and diverse stakeholder coalition that's dedicated to improving motorized mineral prospecting regulations here in Washington State. So just to keep that in mind, and we have our own voices, but there are many more out there to be heard, including the tribes.
And in the principle of adaptive management, we'll do 30 and 30.
Oh, okay.
So
thank you.
I didn't know you had that. So okay.
I appreciate that. Thank you. So the reason TU feels so passionately about this issue is we believe our very precious wild fish populations are at a crossroads right now. And we just have too much at stake, both in terms of the fish themselves, as well as the hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars we're spending on trying to save them, to allow motorized mineral prospecting to continue to occur without oversight and accountability. And that's our message. And as you all know, Washington State is currently being sued because of its inadequate regulations. And our objective is to help the state come into compliance with state and federal law and save the state from a costly lawsuit. I want to emphasize we're not trying to kick anybody off of the water. We simply want a more responsible approach. So I really appreciate the department's summary earlier, and we really appreciate all of the work, and we don't want to discount the time and energy the department has spent on trying to hone these regulations. But the problem is that if there there aren't individual permits and there's no tracking and accountability, the regulations are quite frankly only as good as the paper they're printed on. So that's our main message. The panelists are going to go into some of the details of the inadequacies of the existing regulations. I'm just going to provide a quick overview. There's a lack of compliance with state and federal laws, as I mentioned, and we'll provide details on that. There's a lack of regulatory fairness in terms of one particular user group being treated differently than others. There's a lack of oversight in allowing impacts to sensitive habitats, such as ESA critical habitat. There's no evaluation of cumulative impacts in the current program, which is out of compliance with the ESA. There's a lack of enforcement because of a lack of capacity. We all know the department is strapped. This leads to increased violations, and this is increasing because we have out-of-state use because of the regulations being tightened in other states. Also, we don't have an avenue for invasive species screening and BMPs, so our waterways are at risk of aquatic invasive species havoc. Just a quick example, this was brought to our attention in the last couple days, the Raging River, which is ESA-designated critical habitat for Chinook salmon. The Snoqualmie tribe has observed impacts out in their purview, and they are quite frankly very, very upset about this, and the fact that the current system doesn't have tracking and accountability. We can't know when impacts like this are happening. So it just underscores the need for that change to tracking and accountability through individual permits. Also, there's an issue with work windows. There are, with the diverse life histories of Chinook in this system, there are ESA-listed species in the system all the time. And so the work windows just don't cut it, and we'll provide details on that later as well. I'm not going to go into detail on this because Randy covered it pretty well, but just to briefly touch on the regulations, the status of the regs in other states. In California, there is a moratorium, and this was enacted on the basis of concerns to critical habitat, the release of mercury, and the inability of the state agencies to manage the impacts of these activities. That was challenged in court. It was brought to the state Supreme Court, which upheld the ban. That was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, which refused to hear the appeal, and so the ban holds in California. In Oregon, the new law went into effect at the beginning of January this year, which was preceded by a two-year moratorium, as Randy mentioned. There's a ban in essential salmon habitat. The individual NPDES permits required, as well as landowner permission, including U.S. Forest Service notices of intent, which is key. There are many operations here in Washington that are not submitting notices of intent on Forest Service land. They also require a fee. In Idaho, as Randy mentioned, it's regulated by the EPA under the Clean Water Act. They have a programmatic NPDES permit, but individual permits are required, and there are a number of miners being sued because of failure to obtain these individual permits. Similar to Oregon, there's the critical waters that are closed to mining, including ESA critical habitat. They require a fee, and an invasive species check is required, and also the notices of intent. So again, I'd like to emphasize that we are not trying to kick anybody off the water. We are advocating for a responsible approach. And we believe that includes individual HPA permits that comply with both the ESA and the Clean Water Act to ensure tracking, monitoring, and accountability. Restrictions in habitat that are designated as critical to supporting Washington's wild fish, including ESA critical habitat, and evaluation of cumulative impacts. Regulatory fairness through individual permits and restrictions in sensitive habitat and invasive species screening and BMPs. And I do want to say that every single WDFW staff person we've talked to, from the area habitat biologists all the way up to upper level management, have admitted that the system is broken. And that has been over the last few years, we've heard that. And we are trying to help the state come to where it needs to be. So the rest of our panelists are going to go into details, as I mentioned. I'm going to turn it over to Bill Clark, who's going to provide an overview of the legal framework in Washington State and some evidence for reform. Bill.
Great. Thank you. Good morning, Commission members and Director Storer. I'm Bill Clark. I'm an attorney here in Olympia and do a lot of work in environmental permitting and also across the street with the legislature. Unlike a number of other people here today, I don't have years and years experience dealing with the suction dredge issue, but sometimes that's okay because you can look at an issue with fresh eyes and really look at what is the law, what direction has the legislature already given this agency in terms of how it should regulate motorized suction dredging. The other thing I'll say is I'm an attorney, I'm not a scientist. As to what I'm going to say, the science doesn't matter, right? It may be interesting, you may be interested in it, but the first stop, as far as I'm concerned, as far as you should be concerned, is you have to comply with state law. The legislature has adopted pretty specific legislation on this issue. The department's current program does not follow that specific legislation. I've given you a memo that kind of hits some of the highlights of what I'm going to discuss today. You can take it with you and review it when you have the chance. I'll send it to the department electronically so everybody else here today can look at it too. Part of the effort that brought us to today was a petition that Trout Unlimited filed to modify your rule program for motorized suction dredging. The commission rejected that. In rejecting our petition, the commission said substantial policy decisions affecting the public should be made by those directly accountable to the public, namely the legislature, right? It's the commission saying this is the legislature's decision. The legislature should determine how motorized suction dredging should be regulated. I'm here to tell you that they've already made that decision, and the commission and the department is not following that law. So if you look at number two in my memo, in the 1997 legislation that Pat Chapman described, the legislature said this: the legislature declares that small-scale mining and prospecting, shall be regulated in the least burdensome manner that is consistent with the state's fish management objectives and the Federal Endangered Species Act. So there are three key points there, right? What is small-scale mining and prospecting, the least burdensome manner, and what are the state's fish management and ESA objectives? The legislature also specifically defined small-scale mining and prospecting as follows. It is defined as the use of only the following methods: pans, non-motorized sluice boxes, concentrators, and mini rocker boxes for the discovery and recovery of minerals. Only those methods, right? Moving on, if you want to follow in your own memo, it also then said, this is the legislature in the 1997 law, it's RCW 7755091, the statute's still in place today. Small-scale mining and prospecting shall not require a permit under this chapter if the prospecting is conducted in accordance with rules established by the department, right? In essence, those specific methods of mining within the definition of small-scale prospecting and mining can be conducted under the Golden Fish pamphlet, and they don't require an individual permit. What you'll note is that definition of small-scale prospecting and mining does not include any form of motorized mining. It does not include motorized suction dredging. And yet, since 1997, the department's rule has allowed motorized mining without individual permit review, directly opposite of what the legislature decided in their legislation in 1997. Number six in the memo on the bottom of page two, if you want to follow along. Leading up to the commission's decision on our petition for rulemaking, the Habitat Program sent the commission a memo that said, although the statutory definition of small-scale mining and prospecting did not include motorized mining methods, which acknowledges there are no motorized methods allowed under that statute, the statute didn't prohibit including other methods in the pamphlet. That's wrong. With all due respect to the Habitat Program, the definition says small-scale prospecting and mining is defined as the use of only the following methods. You've probably looked at many statutes through the years. Many times the legislature will tell an agency that an agency can do something including things such as, or including but not limited to, things like X, Y, and Z. That's a signal to the agency that it has some discretion as to what it includes within that regulatory universe. When the legislature says we're going to define something and that definition includes only the following things, that limits the list, right? There's this saying, to list is to limit. The legislature limited the things that can be within the Golden Fish pamphlet specifically to include any form of motorized mining. Following along, number seven, the legislative history of that bill, which is House Bill 1565, is somewhat interesting. The bill ping-ponged back and forth between the House and Senate with a number of different versions until the legislature finally agreed on a version. There was, in fact, a version of that bill that passed one house of the legislature but not the other, and it included in the definition of small-scale prospecting and mining motorized dredging devices with a suction nozzle not greater than 4 inches, right? So there was a version of a suction dredging bill that would have allowed motorized suction dredging with up to a 4-inch nozzle within the Golden Fish pamphlet. What did the legislature do with that version of the law? They didn't pass it. They rejected that version and instead adopted the statute that I read to you that says only the following methods, and they are only non-motorized methods. So obviously you have a difference between what the legislature could have adopted and what they did adopt. If you look at how courts interpret successive pieces of legislation, that creates legislative intent and legislative history that says, hey, the legislature could have included motorized mining. They could have allowed up to a 4-inch nozzle size under the Golden Fish pamphlet. They chose not to. That's evidence that no motorized mining is allowed under the Golden Fish pamphlet. Moving on, the other part of that, we talked about small-scale mining and prospecting, the least burdensome manner possible, and fish management objectives in the Endangered Species Act. I won't go into it at length, but the state steelhead management plan is replete with references to challenges with steelhead stocks, with the reduction of wild fish species, with the fact that while Fish and Wildlife has limited authority to regulate habitat, WDFW has limited authority over land use decisions, but does administer the HBA program, which regulates activities on or near state waters that could affect fish life. Secondly, it also has the obligation to protect under the ESA, to comply with the ESA. As Crystal's gone through, for example, you can have motorized suction dredging in Washington in ESA-listed critical habitat for steelhead or Chinook in the state of Washington. That cannot occur in the state of Idaho, for example. So if you look at it either from the perspective of complying with state law or complying with the ESA, the department's program doesn't do it. Finally, the back few pages that you can take and look at, if you go out the front of the Natural Resource Building and down that little ramp, the kind of goofy underground building is State Archives. State Archives keeps a file of all pieces of legislation ever passed by the state. If you go back to the 1997 law, House Bill 1565, you can see all versions of the bill, testimony, letters, in fact, opposition from the Department of Fish and Wildlife opposing a bill that would have a 4-inch nozzle size within the Golden Fish pamphlet. That's what the department opposed. Letters from miners, letters from fishing groups, etc. What's in your packet is what's called the Conference Committee Report. When the House and Senate pass different versions of a bill and they can't agree, they create a conference committee. The conference committee decides, here's the final version of the bill that's going to pass. The summary of the conference committee report from 1997 summarizes it as follows. Dredging. All dredging requires an HPA. As to the HPA pamphlet, the only things allowed, gold pans, mini rocker boxes, non-motorized sluice boxes, and concentrators. So if you want to try to understand what did the legislature put in place in 97, look at their conference report. Finally, the other piece that is in the legislative history file, and I've left it at the front desk in case any of your assistant attorney generals want to go look at it, and I think they should. Again, the legislative history contrasts the bill that did pass versus the bill that didn't pass. The bill that didn't pass would have allowed motorized suction dredging under the Golden Fish pamphlet. The bill that did pass doesn't allow that. So to go back to where I guess I started, the department's rejection of our rulemaking petition said that these decisions should be made by the people accountable to the public, namely the legislature. And if you look at the information in this packet, the legislative history file, clearly the legislature has made that decision. It adopted a law. It defined what small-scale prospecting and mining is. It specifically defined those types of methods that can be under the Golden Fish pamphlet. It said that only those methods are allowed. And yet, the department's Golden Fish pamphlet goes far beyond that to allow motorized mining in a way that the statute says it should not be allowed. I think I'll leave my presentation at that and move on. Thanks, Crystal.
Now we'll turn to John McMillan.
Commissioners, thank you. My name is John McMillan. Forgive the voice. I somehow managed to survive that nasty cold that was going around. I'm the science director for the Wild Steelhead Initiative for TU, and I know many of you. Thank you for the time to present today. Given that there appears to be some debate within the department over the specific effects and how negative those effects can be for motorized mineral mining, I'm going to kind of keep it on a little bit higher level today and talk about two aspects that I think are important, but that doesn't mean that we don't think the science is important. I'll close with that, and also there's a handout with a review of the literature that's focused on these activities that we provided to all of you. So the first thing I want to overview today is the heavy reliance on these work windows that the department has adopted and why those can be inadequate for regulating mining itself, and then also the court rulings that we've heard a little bit about today, because those court rulings are important because, of course, they're based on the science, the very science that's being debated here today. Why work windows aren't enough? We've got these nice work windows in place, and they make sense, right? They basically provide periods of time when motorized mining can occur, and those windows are in place to largely eliminate or reduce impacts on spawning fish or incubating eggs. However, as I think Crystal mentioned earlier, and as we all know, many species of salmon and steelhead are in fresh water for their entire life, right? Often for multiple years as juveniles, and these work windows don't necessarily account for all those periods of time in which the fish are in there. And the life history diversity of these fish makes it really difficult, because it means that we can have fish that are anywhere from 1 inch in length in there for an entire summer to fish that are several inches in length. And ESA listed salmonids that we know we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on habitat restoration right now to try and protect those fish. And so that's an important consideration, is the large investment we've made in habitat to protect those ESA listed fish. I'd also like to mention that the withdrawal windows themselves don't consider non-salmonids such as lamprey and other fish that we don't often think about as being important because they aren't sport fished as much, but they also don't take into account impacts on invertebrates, the very food sources that those fish need to sustain themselves. So there has been science-based reform in other states, I think, as we heard the department talk about. In California, has largely in 2011, there was a Ninth Circuit Court ruling, and in that ruling basically found that their motorized mineral mining does have take impacts under the Endangered Species Act ruling. So, of course, that means that they reviewed the science that has been debated here today, and they agreed that the science was clear enough to put a ban on motorized mining and put more stipulations on that. And I think the California instituted that moratorium in 2016. So again, they've reviewed the science, looked at, and implemented rules based on that science. A similar result in Oregon. The U.S. District Court ruled for Oregon in favor of the scientific evidence that motorized mineral mining was providing harm to salmonids, was proving harmful to salmonids. And there were also water quality impacts, such as increases in turbidity and increased smothering of important substrates to the fish. The moratorium was instituted in 2016 and upheld against appeals. And, of course, as we mentioned, in Idaho and Oregon, there is currently a ban on motorized mining in places that the ESA considers to be essential fish habitat areas. So lastly, in close, I think with the science, it is pretty clear in this case. We know that it disrupts, as you saw from some of these pictures, the stream geomorphology, the habitat features. And while we have work windows, and within the work window, it's known that larger fish can kind of avoid the mining, we also must remember that a lot of these small streams where mining occurs become dewatered in summer and disconnected, so they're ephemeral, right? We're talking some of these fish are living in single pools for the summer, so they don't have anywhere to fully escape to. The water quality impacts are also important. We can see that increased turbidity. We can see increased sedimentation of the substrate. There's damage to the riparian zone. And I think when you look at all of this, they may seem small in an individual scale, but in watersheds and small streams that are being consistently mined, there can be long-term aggregate impacts.
Okay, so now Leo Bodensteiner, I'm going to take it from here.
Science is important. Excuse me. My name is Leo Bodensteiner. I'm a professor at Western Washington University, where I've been teaching and conducting research for the last 24 years. And I'm here having conducted research on mining and suction dredge mining in Washington. I'm also here as the U.S. Vice Chair of the Skagit Environmental Endowment Commission. Back in 2015, I had the opportunity to look at one of the watersheds where mining occurs. It's the Ruby Creek watershed. It's in the upper part of the Skagit. Ruby Creek drains into Ross Lake, which is part of the commission's purview. And I supervised a research project that was designed to look at changes in water chemistry and some other aspects throughout the watersheds up there, where Slate Creek, one of the tributaries, and Canyon Creek are both areas that experience a high degree of mining, suction dredge mining. In short, after taking samples in June, July, August, and September, June was before any suction mining was present, and then July, August, and September, there's considerable mining effort exerted. We found that the water chemistry did change upstream and downstream. We're looking at upstream and downstream effects. Upstream of mining, we would see one type of water chemistry. Downstream, we would see a change in that water chemistry. We looked at 25 metals. And I've kind of highlighted one thing here. Is one thing is lead occurred downstream of mining activity, actually in a concentration at one point that exceeded the Environmental Protection Agency's continuous criterion for fresh water. That is a criterion to protect all aquatic life. And you can see here the criterion is 2.5 parts per billion. We found 3.1 parts per billion of lead. This is in the water column. This is like taking a water sample out of the water column. And I'll also point out arsenic. We did, you know, we sample all kinds of metals, but arsenic was prominently present downstream of placer mining, suction dredge mining, 1.8 times higher than it was upstream of where placer mining occurred. And I just kind of highlight this. So water chemistry does change in association with areas that are being suction dredge mined. I've quoted, there was a study done by the Forest Service of the fish populations. Not many people go into this watershed, not many recreational users, but Forest Service had conducted fish surveys periodically. The last one I found was in 2001, and Slate Creek, which was one of our study sites, that last statement on there says segments of the channel have been scoured to bedrock by suction dredgers, and then there was a photo associated with that showing some of the, you can see some of the holes and pits. That's a black and white photo from that report. And that's one of the things I want to emphasize, is the amount of dredging that's occurring. When you see some of the larger rivers and a couple dredges, this is a small creek. And if we go to the next slide, please, this is about a one-mile stretch on a small creek. This area is occupied by both bull trout, which are ESA listed, and rainbow trout. And one of the aspects of this watershed is that they have access to much of the watershed. There aren't barriers down low as there are many of the cascade streams. So they are spawning in here. The window in the Golden Fish pamphlet for work is October 1 to February 28th for many of the segments in this area. That is during bull trout spawning season. There are both resident and migratory bull trout in here. And there are 41 individual HPAs that exist for Slate Creek alone. And they allow mining outside of the work window during the period when rainbow trout spawning are with rainbow trout are spawning in the Ross Lake tributaries, which occurs from June to mid-July, 1st of June to mid-July. And I've been involved in looking at those fish when they're spawning. So just some casual observations when we were in there doing our study. We were somewhat surprised. It was our first trip in. There were no miners. The second trip we observed just in the Slate Creek area, about 8/10 of a mile. There were 15 dredges operating in proximity and up to three that were side-by-side. 10 dredges in August, and then after the fires, that was the dry year, 2015, after the fires occurred over in that area, they advised to evacuate, after the first snowfall, there were still five dredges there. One of the miners conveyed to us that we wondered about moving the very largest of boulders. They talked about using cargo nets and pulling them out with trucks, moving them out of the way so they get to the gravel underneath. And I contacted the Forest Service. No notices of intent had been filed for any of the miners in any of the mining that goes on in the Slate Creek and Canyon Creek watersheds. So the other aspect of this is the repetitive aspect, the fact that you have a number of miners in the same streams in the weekend after weekend engaging in removal, the redepositing of the substrate and all the adverse impacts that are associated with that that you can read about in all the different literature reviews. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, for allowing us this time.
4 minutes.
4 minutes. Okay, I'm going to race. My name is Pat Hesselgesser. Today I'm speaking as a advocacy member for the Washington State Trout Unlimited. I am also here to talk about some of the concerns we have regarding the regulatory problems with inequality, regulatory fairness, and lack of oversight of the current, I'm just going to call it the GNF pamphlet, which is to serve in most cases as the HPA for suction dredge mining. This is just the definition, your definition, your staff's definition of the HPA. The only thing I'm going to point out is that the whole purpose of the HPA is to, and it's in the last sentence, protect fish. Next slide, please. This map overlay is going to point out that suction dredge mining is found in critical, designated critical habitat areas where many of our endangered and threatened species, including salmon, steelhead, and bull trout, are, and you just heard that. The yellow dots are mining, and the salmon-colored streams show that how they overlap. The current GNF pamphlet, we feel, is inadequate, next slide, please, for the regulation of suction dredge mining for numerous reasons. You've heard legal and scientific, but also because there's little to no monitoring for compliance. Monitoring is necessary to evaluate adequacy and inadequacy of rules. The extent of mining activities that occur under the GNF pamphlet is currently unknown. There's no way to track the total numbers, and there's no way to track the exact whereabouts of the prospecting. You've already heard the other points that are on here, so I'm going to skip over that. Next slide, please. Miners wish to operate outside the restrictions you've heard today are allowed to apply for a standard individualized HPA, and this would allow them into more sensitive habitat areas and outside of the GNF work windows designed specifically to protect habitat and fish. We know through years of reviewing public documents that their requests are almost never denied. With the upsurge of applicants, because of the influx of people coming into our state to practice this mining, we have significant concerns that the increasing geographic scope and increasing work windows are not conducive to the primary regulatory purpose of protecting fish and habitat. Next slide, please. There's also inequality and a lack of fairness in the GNF pamphlet and the individual HPA issuing, allowing prospecting to occur in waters that are close to fishing, such as the upper reaches of the North Fork of the Tianaway, the lower Peshaston, the Wenatchee, Mason Creek. These are all close to fishing for the specific reason of protecting fish and their habitat, and we applaud that. We love that. Yet, prospecting is allowed. HPAs are granted in these same areas that are closed to fishing. It's unreasonable. It lacks the type of regulatory oversight needed to protect fish and their habitat. The scope for regulating mining activities in our rivers needs to be equitable across all users who may impact fish and their habitat. Last slide. Numerous other commercial and recreational organizations have already raised concerns that motorized mineral prospecting is disruptive and harmful to fish and their habitat. Continuing to allow this type of mining with little to no oversight undermines the tens of millions of dollars invested in salmon and steelhead recovery efforts in our state. Commercial and sport fishing combined generates nearly $3 billion in the state of Washington. The current system is inadequate to protect those taxpayer dollars and the fishing industry. More importantly, it's inadequate to protect fish, which is the sole purpose of the HPA. As a voice for 4,000-strong Trout Unlimited, we ask, now is the time to do something fair, equitable, that makes sense. Thank you.
Thank you. Well-timed, people.
Well, we didn't get you to one of the testimonials, but maybe we can provide during public testimony.
Sure. Fine. Well, thank you. Before we bring up the next panel, any quick questions from the commission at this point?
Mine actually probably is for staff. Crystal mentioned their advocacy for permitting both for fish protection and water quality. And I'm just wondering how much the HPA takes into account water quality issues or whether that really is for another agency. Jeff, do you want to try to give a quick answer to that?
So because our authority is for the sole protection of fish life, the water quality pieces that we get into are water quality impacts on fish life. The broader water quality issues are dealt with through Department of Health.
Thank you.
Did you fill out a form to do
I as part of the panel. Yes.
Okay, then if, instead of filling out one to come up for public testimony, just take your 3 minutes now.
Okay, thank you. I can do this in 3 minutes. And
that's so, thank you.
Anyway, my name's John Bornson, and I am the president of the Clark Skamania Fly Fishers. And our home waters are basically in southwest Washington, and they contain two Gene Bank rivers, actually three if you include the Green River in Cowlitz County. As you know, these rivers, these Gene Bank rivers are really important to us, and I mean us collectively, not only fishermen, but the commission has recognized Gene Bank rivers, and at your last meeting when we simplified the rules, you took account into changing the type of equipment that can be used in these rivers. We really applaud that move. These fish, though, in these Gene Bank rivers also need our protection for their habitat if they're going to reproduce and produce the wild fish strains that we're hoping for. Our organization in the past several years has assisted your organization to improve the fish habitat on the East Fork of the Lewis River. For example, jointly we have conducted snorkel surveys to take counts of fish and where they are spawning. We've also conducted red surveys with the Forestry Department, and there was, if you notice on the spreadsheet that's up here, this is from 2015, and when we did the red surveys, you'll see that we found reds all the way from January through April. Yet, suction dredge mining was allowed all the way through February. So you had times where there were active reds, where we found active reds of spawning steelhead and suction mining occurring simultaneously. Also, our club is very involved in improving the nutrients in the East Fork. And so we take salmon carcasses, tons of them, every year from the North Fork hatchery, dump them into the upper East Fork. On trips where we've gone up there to put these salmon carcasses in the East Fork, we've lately found signs claiming mining stakes. And they're at the same time that we are putting in hatchery fish or carcasses to enhance the nutrition in the same stream. It's really not behooving wild fish to have suction dredge mining at the same time we're putting in salmon carcasses. So I guess our position would first be to stop suction dredge mining in the rivers and streams. It's similar to, like, I'm putting a new dock at Mason Lake. I had to get your approval, your agency's approval, before I could put in that dock. And I can't harm fish habitat. That's basically what we're asking on the Gene Bank rivers. If we can't stop it on all rivers, let's stop it on Gene Bank rivers. If we can't stop it on Gene Bank rivers, let's stop it at the times when the fish are using those for reds.
Thank you, sir.
Yep, thank you.
And thank you all. So, in transition here, I will be calling up for the small scale miners, Sean Wheeler, Scott Brown, Chuck Wilson, Justin Carr. And again, your 30 minutes.
You sit there, I'll sit here.
Commence when you give me the sign.
I'm ready.
I'll wait till everybody sits down.
Ready, Chuck?
wait. I got to make sure. Tammy? Ready? Okay, go.
All right. My name is Scott Brown. I'm the treasurer for Resources Coalition.
I'm not going to bore you with this piece of paper that we put together for you. You've all read it over. Sean's going to talk about a few things on there. What I'd like to do is I'd like to add a little bit of rebuttals towards the previous panel's discussions. For one, in the regulations that were put out by the legislation, they neglected to put in there in Section 402 of the same bill that was put out, that small-scale prospecting mining shall not require a written permit under the chapter if the prospecting is conducted in accordance with the rules established by the department. So therefore, our current fish and gold pamphlet are the rules that are established by the Fish and Game Department. We abide by those rules. And then as well as on the documentation from the gentleman that presented from the college on Ruby Creek. Ruby Creek has no mining on it. Ruby Creek is shut down because it is considered to be part of the scenic highway. To get a permit to even work on that section, you have to apply for a permit. And it is listed in the Golden Fish pamphlet as submit application. It has no window whatsoever for work.
That's a quarter mile in all directions from the scenic highway.
Yep.
Which excludes the creek that they claim they were in during the test.
Now,
not open for any prospecting whatsoever.
Okay. And our claims only take up 0.009% of the state waters. It's estimated that 70,000 miles of streams in the state of Washington, and we take up less than 1% on our federal mining claims. Now, as for notices of intent, POOs, small-scale miners are not required by law to put in a POO or a notice of intent because we're not using heavy equipment. To use the heavy equipment, then, of course, plan of operations, notice of intent, and a reclamation bond has to be put out. POOs and notices of intents are being accepted, but no permits are being issued for those on a larger scale basis. They're on hold because there is no funding to have the staff to do it. Then, on the Ninth Court of Appeals in 2005, it states that environmental activists must prove harm to the species of the endangered fish, not just allege it or invoke the Endangered Species Act. They must present actual evidence that these species are likely being harmed before an injunction or can be used or issued against us, the property owners. Our federal mining claims are considered to be real property. We pay fees every year to have those federal mining claims. They are $155 for every 20 acres, which gives us the right to take the minerals off of those claims. It doesn't prevent them from going in and fishing. It doesn't prevent anybody from camping. It doesn't prevent anybody from hiking. They just can't take material off the land. Those are our rights. We pay for those through the federal government, the BLM, and the county gets the filing fees as well. Now, if they cannot produce legitimate fish take or harm to the species, then it's null and void. We abide by those rules that are set in our current Golden Fish pamphlet to the T. As for regulating and being inspected, I was inspected a total of 4 times last year with my younger brother. Fish and Game enforcement officers came up. First thing he looked for, screen intake to make sure that we were within the regulations. Number two, he checked my nozzle size to make sure I was within the regulations. Number three, checked my fueling point. Where am I refueling? Where is my fuel being stored? And number four, checking to make sure that we are abiding by the pamphlet stating backfill our holes. And I had 4 inspections last year. And every single one of those 4 inspections, there was not one problem. I have had reports from other miners that they were inspected as well. And the same thing, no issues. Our areas that we mine on are in areas, one particular one that I will mention is on the Peshastin system, Scotty Creek, North Shazer, Middle Shazer. That system, according to the Douglas County PUD, in conjunction with Chelan County PUD, the Peshastin system is incapable of sustaining any salmonoid life at any stage because of the construction of Highway 97. When they took and built the highway, they leveled everything that was in the way of the highway into the stream. They changed the morphology of it. They changed the temperatures. They changed everything about it. and it's been determined that that cannot sustain salmonoid life at any stage. Yes, there are rainbow trout up there. Okay, there are probably brook trout up there, but no steelhead, no Chinook salmon. And on top of that, we actually have in our possession the documentation from the Department of Fish and Wildlife on the fisheries that were introduced into that system to the tune of 2.25 million fish since 1938, ranging from rainbow trout all the way up to sculpin. And all the fish that they have gone and counted have been downstream at Camas Creek, Negro Creek, which the name is in the process of being changed, and they have a pit ray machine up there that's just outside the U.S. Forest Service land. Fish go up and come back down. They get reverse counting. It counts going up, counts coming back down. But they get to a point and they can't get up any farther. There is really, literally no place for them to spawn. So, in that, I'm going to let Sean take over from that. Let him have those on everything there. Thank you for your time.
Yes, thank you for having us.
Yeah. Yes.
I'm not sure if we should ask questions now or wait to the end, but I do have a question for you all. The I've seen you testified before, and you do a very good job presenting your case. My question is, assuming that you and all the other miners here and in the state follow the rules of the Golden Fish Pamphlet, what do you think about the previous testimony that said, yeah, well, we may not have the authority to permit, per the legislation, motorized section dredge mining absent an HPA? So what do you think about that, and how do you feel about being permitted to continue mining but doing it with an individual permit?
And before, I'm just wondering about the time, because they're 30 minutes, so okay. That can't eat.
That's okay. We can answer.
I don't think the department has the staff or the biologists to be able to do that.
Okay. Yeah. I don't want that to take away from your time, though. You get your 30 minutes.
Yeah, that's fine. Thank you for having me. Actually, it's my first time speaking in front of you guys. I've been doing this since 2001, and I've actually gained a lot of information over the years. And basically, the Department of Ecology did a effects on small-scale dredging, arsenic, copper, lead on the Similkameena River. This was back in 2005. Now, we did send you a 181-page document that was used to make the 2008-2009 rules. So there is information that was sent to you, as well as the, I think it's the 1998 literature that was used as well to make that. But based on analyzing 14 effluents of 27 samples of flumes, it appears that small-scale gold dredges have little or no potential to cause exceedances of aquatic life criteria in the Similkameena River. Basic arsenic and zinc concentration in dredge-related samples were one of two orders of magnitude lower than criteria, and copper and lead concentrations were up below criteria, except for one or two effluent samples slightly exceeded that on sites 4 and 5, and that's in that 181-page report. Now, a lot of your questions when Randy Thurston sent us an email of, you know, how does dredging improve fish habitat and the fish itself. Trout production was significantly increased in physically sculpting and altering the stream bed. The effects of regulated section dredge mining are insignificant. Science favorable to suction dredge mining does exist. However, all available science on the effects of suction dredge operations are based on unregulated operations involving basically the large impact of large-scale operations at ignoring all established rules. So that's why we're regulated by the Golden Fish Book. There was an environmental study that was done that could find no published or unpublished documentation of any mortality to trout embryos or pre-emergent fry in natural streams from the regulated use of suction dredge mining, which is good. And basically, there was another petition to use suction dredges to remove gold from basically a 20-mile stretch reach of the Boise River system. And their conclusion, which is the environmental study, this is after our review of the published and unpublished literature on the effects of the recreational suction dredge use on fish and fish habitat in the western United States, the environmental makes the following conclusions. It says impacts to fish and fish from the regulated use of recreational suction dredges in the petitioned reach of the Boise River upstream basically will be non-detectable to minimal. So we do not cause harm to fish or their habitat. We actually make it better. And that's where I'm going to end it there.
My name is Justin Carr. I am president of Slate Creek Mining District and vice president of Resources Coalition. Been doing this for about a decade. Got pulled from spending my time suction dredging into the clubs and legislation and rulemaking and everything else. So I have actual experience underwater doing all this. It's like I say, the biologist, when I do my actual hydraulic permits, I have 9 hydraulic permits in the state of Washington. There's only one other person that has more than me. So that person probably is the only one that has more experience doing this than I do. A few of the problems I have are what they were mentioned before is the Slate Creek Mining District. That's my mining district. First mining district in 100 years in Washington State to be federally backed. We are completely reorganized. We also work with the Seattle City Light with all the dams that are up there, which we all know there's no fish passage on any of them 5 dams, hydraulic dams up there on Highway 20. He reports to me that they have the healthiest fish stocks in the state of Washington, which I'm pretty sure WDFW can back that up. So from what they said, it's complete opposite from what we know with the people we work with, and that's basically our backyard. You haven't knocked on my door to come inside, but you're telling me you know what's inside. It doesn't work that way. When it comes to the hydraulic permits, you don't just fill out a piece of paper, turn it in, and they're like, okay, great, here you get your permit. You meet one of the biologists and have a site walk, and you walk and study the entire river, reeds, boulder size, plants, embedded material, all of that stuff. You walk it with the biologist, every foot of it, measuring it. And in the permit, it tells you exactly where you can and where you cannot run your motorized dredge in that location. And that is worked with the biologist specifically. So it's not just to sign a piece of paper, here you go, no problem, go have fun. It doesn't work that way. It's way more strict than any of these people think it is. And I invite anybody, I will fill out an HPA for a random location, go through the entire process with you all the way to where my permit is issued by the biologist to let you know it is not a simple procedure. It's very in-depth, very detailed. On top of all that, I would like to state that in the last 21 years of the state, millions and millions of dollars, thousands and thousands of hours have been spent to come up with these rules and regulations over the last 21 years. Department of Ecology has been there, the state's been there, Department of Fish and Wildlife's been there, the tribes have been there, and the miners have been there. Not once has Trout Unlimited been to any of them rulemaking meetings or anything in the last 21 plus years of us working on this. That upsets me that they're the ones coming in and doing this now. After 21 years of all of us doing this, they're going to come in now and try and do something about it. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Chuck Wilson. I'm president of the Washington Prospectors Mining Association and the president of the recently refurbished, I guess you'd call it, Sultan Mining District up in Sultan. I'm taken aback a little bit by format, almost. When I started putting together information for this particular briefing, there are 3 questions to look at and to ask. How does suction do this? How does this do this? Yet, right off the gate, we hear this barrage of information, and I think from a point of view of fairness, it would behoove all of us, especially the commission, to allow the mining people to have a point-by-point counter rebuttal, or at least the other side says this is the actual facts. Because I was writing notes as I was listening to this, and one statement was made that everybody, all the staff members in WDFW, says that the system's broken.
Not true.
That was said here just a little while ago. And yet, that was news to me, because we work very closely with Randy and her staff. We have worked and forged a much closer relationship with them in the fact that we're on the river, we're out there, we want them and us to work together as a team to make sure we all do what is required to protect the fish and the habitat. And so to hear something like this come up that says everybody in WDFW says that the system's broken was just a shock. In listening to a lot of the other testimony, there must be, I kind of lost count because I don't write too fast anymore because I've typed too much over my life. As a matter of fact, I can't read anything hardly that I've written here. And I'm an engineer, so I can't write worth anything anyway. So my point is this, is that it would be very nice to have the time and luxury of going through the televised broadcast and get a transcript of everything, and then on the other side of the column present the other facts that counter a lot of those things that you heard today, because there weren't a lot of substantial facts, and there were some statements made that was speculative at the most. You know, I wrote this piece of paper here because I thought we were supposed to come here and say what suction mining does for the and doesn't do and that sort of a thing. So, but after hearing this other testimony, it's just kind of it's a mute point at this point. I think I'd like to ask or point a couple of other things out. There seems to be an assumption that if you have a river, all that river is habitat for fish. In reality, is when fish come into the river, they're looking for areas that have rocks that are less than 4 inches in diameter or 5 inches in diameter, and that the bed material is not cement. It's just, you know, someplace that they can actually use their little tails and make a hole, right? So when you look at a whole river, there's only sections, smaller sections of certain rivers. In some areas, there's more gravel than others. But there's a lot of areas in rivers that is nothing but boulder fields and cobble fields. And in those areas, you know, even if you're going to work outside of a timing window, you have to get an HPA. Biologist comes out and says, you know, there's not a fish on the face of this earth other than a blue whale could move those boulders, so go ahead, work those areas. But so my point on this is the habitat in the river that's available for fish, all of us miners have been told for a number of years, rocks this big and smaller, stay away from them. If it's gravel, stay away from them. That's where the little fishies are. Great. That's fine. We work with that, and that's part of our stewardship on the river. But to make a blanket statement that an entire ecosystem is being just decimated by the small number of dredgers that are out there needs a counter to it. I mean, there's so much areas in those rivers that you just fish swim through. They just go through it and they go up to the place they want to go and have a nest and, you know, raise their family and everything like that. So I was really disturbed by that. So anyway, I think that the system that we have now in open timing windows is a good one. I'll give you an example. Up in the Salton River, just recently, they did a piece of work on the diversion dam. It opened up the Reach 3 area, which goes from the diversion dam of the city of Everett up to Spada Lake Combeck Reservoir. They did that as part of the relicensing of the dam to allow fish to come up the river. So now we have fish up in the river. And there's a lot of sections in that river that is just these big rocks and boulders. And yet there's some areas that are free-flowing that have lots of gravel. As Justin says, part of the process, you know, the biologists come out there, they meet with us, we hike down the canyon, we fight the bears and the cougars, keep them away from the habitat folks, and they take paint and they spray the rocks. Green on this side, red on that side. There's some concern about painting rocks. I called up Joe Neal, the ranger that we work with up there. And he said, you know, minimize the paint, but I'm okay with it since it's on forest land. So I just really want to emphasize is that the areas where the fish lay eggs, dig holes, the little guys come on out and start swimming around, there it's protected, and we all do that. And I think it's very much a track record that we've been establishing over the last number of years of working with the commission, working with WDFW to make sure everybody does it. We also self-police. A lot of the clubs, whenever we hear that there's some no-name person out there doing something stupid, we go and hold school on those people. And if they're doing something they're not supposed to be doing, we throw them out of the organization. Just plain and simple. That's not appreciated, I think, or communicated, because we all care very much about the environment. So I think in closing, I really would like, you know, if it comes down to it, there were so many open-ended statements made earlier on that I know there's specific information that counters that to give a fair and balanced type of a consideration for what's being asked here. I think that's an important point to consider and as a follow-on to this. So anyway, thank you.
Thank you all, and I will open it up for questions from the commission. And I would like to follow up with Commissioner Baker said first, because I wasn't really kind of threw me off guard, but the answer and the timing, but the authority issue that she mentioned, Attorney Clark was pretty specific in his points made.
I also think his dates are quite outdated. The Fish and Gold pamphlet's been updated multiple times since then.
Yeah, we're currently on the 2015.
We're on issue 4 of 2015. It's been changed 20 times since then.
That's one issue that I think we have to come to some closure on.
Just got to read the new rule book.
Okay.
WDFW given the authority to make changes on the pamphlet and the rules in it.
Okay.
That's a big thing. And with them saying that this is our permit. That's our HPA during the time windows, which start back of page 17.
Any other time, you have to go through the hydraulic permit.
And let me, before then I'll turn it over. Biologist. Thank you. If you wish to raise or to respond to, please feel free to do that and send your correspondence to us.
That's good. I appreciate that, and we'll see about doing that. The only problem that we have is a lot of us we're either working or we're not, and we're not highly paid consultants from anybody. That's a problem, because I recognize on the staff that was up here, there's a lot of people paid a lot of money to do this 8 hours a day, and a lot of us aren't. So there is somewhat of a, liability.
The questions that were raised, that were asked, I think were open to interpretation. You know, suction, sure. The effect of suction direct, that's sure. Pretty broad. So I'm going to I'll start. You want to follow? No, we'll work on down.
I did ask my question prematurely. Did not mean to throw you off. I'd like to just point out that I think it's a great idea for you all to have a chance to rebut those some of the positions of the previous panel. I'm particularly interested in the authority issue, so I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Mr. Grable?
Justin, how many times were you inspected or seen by enforcement this past year?
This past year, twice.
Yeah, twice. Okay,
yep.
Thank
First
you.
First thing they go to is my screened intake.
And as most miners know, and Washington State biologists know, mine's twice as small as the legal limit in Washington State.
It exceeds the limit.
They would like to put it up on a trophy podium and say, hey, all you miners got it. But
ours is too. I mean, you have the metal screen that's a little tiny holes, but then I always go ahead and put window screen over on top of that.
I was also curious about where you refuel.
Refuel.
It's done outside the wind.
Outside the water area.
Okay.
And dredges out of the water. Up on
that's earth. Usually the first thing they check a biologist when they stop on site is where's your fuel. It's got to be in the shade up 15, 20 feet away from the water.
So
it's not
going to
be, even if it spilled a 5 gallon thing, it would come nowhere near the water.
So you pull up to where the fuel is.
And to avoid that, having to deal with the fuel, I have found an option that I'm going to run over to change my system over from petroleum gas to liquid propane, which is in a contained bottle that all I have to do is disconnect the hose, take the bottle, put it away, put the new bottle on. Back up and running. No more pulling equipment or damaging the ecosystem with fuel.
I don't know that if I did mention in my statement that we did work with the Department of Ecology for the Quicksilver Award, small-scale miners, and we did recycle over 300 pounds of mercury.
In actuality, it was 752 pounds in a 10-year period of time that was turned into the DOE during 2004 to 2004.
They awarded us for it.
And in 2008, we were awarded the Quicksilver Award by the Department of Ecology.
Mr. McCarthy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one quick question as an opportunity for rebuttal. In the earlier panel, you heard one gentleman say that hydraulic mining was allowed during the spawning time for winter steelhead in the East Fork of the Lewis River. Do you have another side to that story?
Well, I can't tell you. For one, I'm not the four hydraulic dams that got built, and they're blocking their problem with the fish in the first place. I think we'd all agree the dams need to go. Second of all, I'd like to know even one suction dredge miner that dredges the Lewis River. If you send them my way, I'll answer your question.
Lewis River is not located in federal mining claim areas. It's not U.S. Forest Service land. It is actually privately owned and state-owned land.
That location. And all
No mining claims are on there.
It's moot because there's no minerals and there's no point to be suction dredging that waterway. So
I'm sorry, we don't take questions from the audience. Thank you. Okay, thank you. Oh.
Okay, good.
All right, thank you, gentlemen. Commissioner Q.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I share Commissioner Baker and Commissioner Chair Smith's, you know, kind of the one of the big issues certainly is the regulatory authority. And we're not going to decide that here today. I will kind of just, you know, I see that the statute was enacted in 1997. It's a little, you know, curious to me that there's not been a challenge in to this in 21 years until now. But that's beside the point. I'm just going to say that out. I don't really need a response. I'm just going to putting it out as a comment. Thank you, sir. You did answer my question that I asked the staff about the permitting process. I mean, if we were to go beyond the Golden Fish Pond.
It is a very strict process.
Yeah, and it would certainly, I think, your comment is it would take more staff time, and it could delay things. I mean, that's all good information for me to know. One question, though, that I did have, and the issue was raised by department staff, and then also I think in the folks from Trout Unlimited, the panel, was the as a result of restrictions in California and Oregon, that we're seeing more small-scale prospectors here in Washington. And you guys are the folks on the gravel, excuse the pun, but I was just wondering what your perceptions are. And there's no, I mean, certainly it would be anecdotal, but I'm just curious.
I think it was early last year in legislation, they tried to tell us that there was 500 to well over 2,000 out-of-state suction dredgers coming here to mine, because of the other moratoriums and bans in the other states, and that's just not true. Anybody here can log into the app system and look and see where the permits are issued to and what state and where they live. I'll be honest, I can step out and check. It takes 5 minutes to look, but I highly doubt that there's any out-of-state suction dredgers that have a permit.
Well, another thing, too, is
You have to be members of certain prospecting clubs in where, you know, the gold prospecting takes place, and we did not see an increase in those memberships or anything like that. So, I mean, for them just to go out and prospect, you know, I guess that can happen, but generally where gold production is, you need to be a member of those claims. So,
and that is punishable by law if they do mineral trespass under RCW 7844330.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen. We will now go to public input on this issue, and we have a number of folks that wish to provide public input. And for many of you, it might be the first time you're doing this. You've heard the buzzer. It's three minutes. And please adhere to that. I will call you up two at a time. And so we'll keep rotating through. So Brad Troussel and Neil Hoffberg, please.
Hi, my name is Brad Troussel. I am the president for Trout Unlimited for the state of Washington, and we have approximately 4,400 members throughout the state. I want to be real clear, we're not asking for mining to be banned, okay? That is not our request. You know, a lot of things have been brought up in the testimony today. Obviously, Trout Unlimited brought up their side of the story. The miners brought up their side of the story. But I think we all know that, you know, this is a subject we don't know enough about. We do know that states around us have decided to limit mining more than we do. California, you know, as you heard, is in a moratorium. Idaho, you know, increased their supervision over it in restricted areas. What we're asking is Washington to take the same serious look at suction dredge mining that the other states have taken. Okay, the gentleman behind me, the miners, I'm sure there's a number of miners who follow the law, who are, you know, who do a wonderful job, who are very careful. But there are a lot of miners that we're not aware of. There's licensing issues, there's permitting issues, there's enforcement issues, and the rules need to be re-looked at. You stated they haven't been looked at since 97. I think that is way beyond time to revisit this and to look at it and to make scientifically based, intelligent decisions on, you know, where people can mine, the kinds of permits and licenses they need to do that, the kind of follow-up the state needs to do to make sure that they're doing it, you know, safely and keeping, you know, fish number one. That's what we're really concerned about, is keeping fish number one. And so that's what we're asking for. We're asking for the, you know, to revisit and look at what's going on, and let's update it. Let's not be 1997. Let's be 2018 and make decisions based on science of today. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Harvey Morrison, please. And Neil. Neil?
I'm Neil.
Yeah,
Neil.
No, you go. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
Is the mic working?
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
Here it doesn't sound like it is. Thank you for the opportunity, ladies and gentlemen. I appreciate it. Thank you to the miners also for allowing me a couple minutes. It's been very illuminating being here this morning and this afternoon. Virtually everybody from the Trout Unlimited side, and that's where I'm with, and I'm also a member of good standing of Sierra Pacific Fly Fishers down in Los Angeles, California, and the Washington Fly Fishing Club up here in Seattle, which is a big environmental fly fishing club. Everybody has very eloquently stated what they had to state on both sides. So I would like to second and be seen as another voice with what Brad just reiterated, that you really take a deep dive into what's going on, where are we at with it, and what changes need to be. And particularly, I'd like you to take a look at it. I'm a salesman, so I tend to talk. I was in high-end medical sales selling $2 million MRIs and lots of very sophisticated medical equipment for over 35 years. It became very apparent to me that if I try to argue point by point by point by point, I'm probably not going to win the sell with you. Yes, you need to know what I'm doing, what my equipment does. You need to know what I'm doing as a fly fisherman, that I fish barbless, that I release all my fish, that I probably only killed one fish in the last two or three years that I know of. But to really be successful in every endeavor, I think, nowadays, especially when it comes to anything regarding the environment, and this is so that the miners have a place to go to also down the road, where are we at today and where do we want to be tomorrow? Things, especially with the environment, really need to be looked at from the 35,000-foot level. I can sit here, if I had all the facts, and go toe-to-toe with anybody that's representing the miners. The miners could go toe-to-toe with me, and that's not going to get us anywhere. That's not going to get to any kind of compromise. That's not going to get us anywhere down the road where I've got a place to fly fish 5 years, 10 years from now, where my son does, where my grandchildren, if I ever have grandchildren, do. And likewise, I would think same with you for the miners. It would be very easy for me to say or to rebut what the engineer just said so eloquently, is that nothing happens downstream. That's not true. There's a cause and effect for everything, but maybe what you're talking about in a certain area will not do it from there. But if you do it every year, year over year over year, do we then show up 7 years from now and all of a sudden we have nothing left? The environment is already under tremendous assault by a lot of different factions in the country, from big business organizations, coal, whatever you want to get into, political or not, non-political. So I would really like to ask you to take a look in the mirror and say, what do we really need to do here? You know, how can we best resolve it so that it's a win-win for everyone, and so that miners, fishermen, canoers, kayakers have something to go to in the future? Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, sir. Mark Taylor, please, and Harvey.
I'm Harvey Morrison. I'm the past president and currently the conservation chair of the Spokane Falls chapter of Trout Unlimited. My personal opinion is that our watershed in Spokane is probably the most heavily impacted in the state by the legacy of mining. So we're living with it over there constantly. We're spending a lot of money to clean up our river. As an angler and a hunter, I am happy, I'll say happy, to spend my money on licenses and fees to hunt in at least four different states annually, because I know that money's going to good causes within those agencies of each of the four Northwest states. Personally, I make it a point. I think I have pretty strong ethics for the outdoors. I respect private property, respect the resource that we have, and I respect the work that the enforcement people of WDFW do. It bothers me a bit that they're out there having to enforce mining regulations when they should be out there enforcing fish and wildlife regulations, I believe, more than that. But that's another issue. The rulemaking that's going on right now, I just want to encourage that it conform with the ESA, the Clean Water Act, and the state's Shoreline Management Act. I think the rules that apply to the miners should be no less stringent than that are applied to me as a volunteer or a construction consultant in doing restoration work on our river. And I believe that the work that the mining operations should be considered a substantial development on these rivers and require permitting under the Water Shoreline Management Act. I think that's about it. I said I was going to try to make it brief when I started, and I'll do that right now. And thank you again for letting us speak before you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. We appreciate that. Dennis Peterson, please, and Mark.
Thank you, members of the commission. Thank you for allowing me time to speak. I represent Trout Unlimited. I'm a member of the Board of Trustees. I also sit on the Washington State Invasive Species Council as a volunteer, as the NGO seat on that council. We want to make sure that we're not spreading aquatic invasives. Again, more regulation, more oversight over anybody that's in our waters. I mean, regardless of all the fish rules and which we all love our fish and whatnot, but if those zebra mussels make it into the Columbia system, all of this other stuff's kind of moot, the amount of money we're talking about and whatnot. So I just want to make sure that we're taking that into account. I know there are bad people that are catching fish that are not doing the right thing. I've seen guys take too many fish, told them that I'm on them, and, you know, they need to stop. We've seen it in the paper. There's probably, you know, most of these guys behind us, the miners and the fishermen, they're good guys. They're doing what they need to do and doing it right. But there are people in both things that are not doing the right thing. So oversight's important for both sets of users on the stream, and that's pretty much all I have. And I support everything that you've heard from the Trout Unlimited folks. We we know what we're talking about. So thank you for your time.
I'm from Michigan originally, so I could tell you about zebra mussels.
Yeah.
Ronald Wilson, please. And Dennis?
Dennis Peterson, president of Bedrock Prospectors. I'm a board member at large of the Blewett Mining District. I, too, brought a pamphlet with me. This is the latest one I could find. It's from 1985, so it's not like we've never had any rules here. So that was the point I was wanting to make. But it's been made about five times, so what I'm going to do is kind of go off script. I have a prepared statement here, but I'm not going to try and read it to you. The thing I wanted to point out was is that they're talking a lot about other states and the rules that they put in place. And those are decisions that those states made based on information that they had and reason that they wanted to do it. One of the problems I have is that California has had this, have completely stopped all dredging in the state for a very long time. And yet we have never heard, and I can't find anything that says that they've improved their fish runs at all. Matter of fact, it's still declining. And why? Well, it ain't the miners, I got to tell you.
Now,
they've been gone for 9 years. So something should have happened. Now, I know there's lots of things going on and there's lots of reasons for it, but the point I'm trying to get at is that this mining community is not the huge mother load and big Thor's hammer beating on fish. These folks are not addressing real issues. We have problems with seals, for Christ's sakes, down here, eating all of our fish. We got problems with cormorants, other birds, all kinds of other things going on. Of course, we've got all this money going into habitat, and yet I have not seen one report that tells me that there's been a big improvement in fish runs because of some improvement made on a habitat. Do I think habitat improvement is important? You're damn right I do. I fish in this state just like everybody else does, but the problem I have is that I don't see anybody talking about some of these big improvements that are going on. Where if we do this, it's going to get better. If we do this, it's going to get better. Sounds like a political thing. Well, I'll tell you what. We've got to see some results from some of this stuff, and it's not going to happen just because we've done a lot of money spent on some special bulkhead we put in on a river somewhere. So what my point is folks, when you go through this and look at it, you got people over here on this side telling you all kinds of facts and data. I worked for facts and data my whole life, and there's always error bands with that. There's information that's not there, omissions of information that didn't come through. And it's all because I have an agenda. All right? So as you're looking through this, think about that. What's the agenda? What's the purpose? What are they trying to do? And what is the purpose? Our purpose is to try and save the fish. We want our runs back. But some of this stuff isn't working. And attacking gold miners, this small group, that ain't going to do it. There's more to it than just that. And with that, I'm going to stop.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Bruce Beatty? No. This isn't a reality TV show. you only applaud when I stand up. That's all. Boo. Now you got me all screwed up here. Bruce Beatty, please. Bruce and Ronald, bring civility back to the order.
I'll try to. My name is Ronald Wilson. I'm from Graham, Washington. It's been some time since I have been before the commission. All the faces have changed, evidently. I don't see anything familiar. I only have two items today. I'll try and be brief. I see we also have a very scientific slanted commission here, so we'll start with that. At one time, I figured out the number of claims in Washington versus the amount of stream miles. The amount of stream miles in Washington is a neighborhood of 70,000 miles. The amount of claims, I won't go the whole thing. Anyways, I figured out the amount of claims, figured either 3 or 15 foot of each claim would be mined each and every year. And the total amount of stream that would be affected came out to be 0.009 of 1% of the stream miles in the state of Washington. So I see little effect even if we did all that mining. All these claims are not mined to that much every year, if they're even mined at all. And as my understanding goes, anytime something falls below 0.5%, it's out of scientific notation. It's not of note to science. So that being my point, 0.009 versus a half a percent. I think we're way out of kilter here on the effects of small stream of stream mining. My second item is under the RCW 9048 waters of the state of Washington or the Shoreline Act. It's my understanding that the commission will be ruling on the waters of the state of Washington as defined. Is that your understanding also, if we go to this definition, the waters of the state of Washington, that's what you'll be making rules for them waters only?
Yes. This isn't a question and answer. Period. This is
This is a fact finding.
But we're not in a position to just respond to.
I'm just trying to find out some facts.
My birthday is May 26th.
So. Yeah. So, anyways, that being my point, if anything is outside the preview of the state of Washington waters as defined, then it would not apply to us, or whatever your rulings would be would not apply to that. So that's what I have to say. Any questions?
Thank you. Scott Atkinson and Bruce.
Congratulations, Joe, on your promotion. You've seen me now for about 18, 20 years. My name is Bruce Beatty. I'm from University Place. I've been a fly fisherman since 1947. I'm a suction dredger, and I would never damage fish habit for salmonids nor trout. I want to keep in, by the way, I'm looking up here, I notice that there's a lot of gold rings. Thank you for buying our product. Okay? That gold could have come from this state.
That's a good one.
Keep in mind, levity. Keep in mind what we are discussing is a national security issue related type of business. We're not recreationists. We're in business. The 1872 Mining Law Act is protected by the supremacy, property, and the commerce clauses of the U.S. Constitution and cannot be preempted by later land use acts such as the Multiple Use Act and such as FLTMA or the Organic Act. It's in a high elevation setting. Only Congress can change the 1872 Mining Law. It's federal law that we're working on in the National Forest and the BLM lands. The U.S. cannot manufacture national defense equipment without the uncommon valuable mineral, silver, gold, platinum, molybdenum, palladium, on and on, tin. In 2005, Bedrock Prospectors hosted a workshop up on the Natchez River for the House Natural Resources Committee. The chairman was Brian Sullivan. And Representative Brian Blake, Orcutt, Hatfield, Eichmeyer, Sump, and Brendan Williams attended. You may have received the letter from Brendan Williams on the 8th. I have a copy if you don't. Who is Brendan Williams? He's a lifetime member of the Sierra Club. He was in attendance at that workshop on the Natchez River. Also attending was the former chairman of this commission, Gary Gutzweiler. Resources Coalition held rallies up on the Similkameen River in Oroville. Commissioner Gutzweiler attended again, as well as Chuck Perry and Dr. Chu. Commissioner Gutzweiler attended three of those rallies. Commissioner Perry and Chu attended two of those rallies. Also, Resources Coalition conducted a three-day workshop up on the Similkameen River in which WDFW personnel, DNR personnel, ecology personnel attended. Okay? And Stella Short was there. She was an aide for Kathy Morris Rogers at the time. She was there for 3 years. Conclusion, I don't believe anyone listed that I just mentioned had any concerns over suction dredging after observing it. Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce. Daryl Johnson, please, and Scott.
Thank you for providing us the opportunity to come and visit today. And it's nice to see so many new faces and some of the familiar faces the last time I met with you folks at one of the other meetings in Vancouver or Alderwood. I used to be the president of Northwest Mineral Prospectors in Oregon. And at one time we had 700 members after the Gold Rush show came out. People found out it was hard work. People found out you couldn't walk down the stream and pick up nuggets like they showed on the TV show. You actually had to dig a little bit of dirt. You had to make an effort. You had to get your hands cold. You had to go out in the rain. People didn't like that. The TV show gave people a false impression. We hear a lot of stories about the miners. A lot of those are episodes from long gone history about how the streams were destroyed by hydraulic mining. The fish survived. Every year, you guys have reports of rivers that flood over their banks, run through their farms, and bring all kinds of sediment and silt into the rivers. The fish survive. One of the things that I found when I was in Trout Unlimited years ago was the Trout Unlimited folks didn't go after the commercial fisheries like the herring roe fishery, because the commercial fishing industry has as many lobbyists and as many lawyers as Trout Unlimited did. The environmental groups don't go after the big, powerful lobbies because they have to spend money that they usually don't win. The environmental groups have a Bible. California has followed that Bible. They've shut down logging. They've shut down mining. They've shut down a lot of other industry. The economy in California is about ready to go bankrupt if it shouldn't already. I was on the governor's work group in Oregon when we discussed the mining that ended up being Senate Bill 3. The fix was in before we started with those governor's work group meetings. There were specific environmental representatives, there were specific tribal representatives, and there were four miners that represented the mining industry in Oregon. The fix was in. We were told that we were not allowed to talk about mining law. I was asked, because I was involved in the Golden Fish development from 2007 to 2009, at the same time Trout Unlimited was invited to participate and failed to, I took copies of the Golden Fish pamphlet to the governor's work group in Oregon, and the facilitator said, we're not going to talk about what Washington did with their Golden Fish pamphlet. And then turned right around and said, but look what California did, so we have to copy California. I have more.
Everybody
Thank
does.
Thank you. Any questions?
We got a limit. Thank you, sir. Lightning. Craig Ormsberg? Sorry. And Daryl?
Thank you for having me.
Excuse me, what?
I'd rather not.
Oh, okay. Fine. Thank you. Then Ross Logan, please. And now Daryl.
Thank you.
Just keep talking.
Yeah, just talk into it.
Thank you for having me. My name is Daryl Johnson. I'm with Citizens Alliance for Property Rights. And I'm watching this unfold. It strikes me an awful lot like the sue and settle strategy that was used by the Green Machine until the Ninth Circuit deemed it unconstitutional. And I find a lot of this is driven mostly by an almost religious fervor by environmentalists. They see all human activity as negative and harmful. It's I call them evangelical eco-jihadists because they're so focused that all resource extraction is bad. I would have rather been better prepared, but I just came across these yesterday, so I can't I just started to wade through it, but there is a large body of peer-reviewed science that indicates that regulated, properly done suction dredge mining has no significant impact on fisheries, and that I believe that this is as much a function of feeling as rationale. And I've watched as these various pushes, examples with buffers, they start out small and they never quit expanding. Every few years, buffers get expanded, whereas actual science shows that with some variations with topography in general, the health of a riparian stream, any buffer beyond 25 feet is virtually irrelevant. And yet you will now see buffers supposedly to protect streams extending out 300-400 feet. I perceive this as being the exact same thing. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And Dean Fennerly, it's getting late. I'm starting to lose it here. Ross?
Thanks for letting me come up here. I was born here in Vancouver, Washington. I grew up in Camas, Washington. I am a veteran. I'm college educated. I got into mining as a result of meeting Mr. Scott Atkinson. And I got my eyes opened up. I always, you know, saw the old movies, saw the old duffer wandering around with his burro, you know, and stuff like that. But I started learning about what it's really all about, you know, and I got the pamphlets. I was reading. I learned how to do it the proper way, the clean way. When you dig a hole and you're done, you fill it back up. And then I saw dredges. Well, there's a gentleman sitting in the back of the room with a Marine Corps hat on, and I bought a dredge from him because I saw just how efficient it was and eliminated a lot of hard work. And it didn't hurt the river. It didn't hurt the stream. And I was amazed by that. And what really got my attention about the dredge is when I was in the water with it, and the water was deep enough, I could turn around and look at the outflow from the sluice box, and there was a great big bunch of fish back there darting in and out and feeding on the debris coming out, because the intake that I am moving around, sucking up the dirt and the rock and whatever's in front of it, it's got bugs in it that the fish like to eat. So I'm feeding fish. Besides picking up whatever else is on there, I'm moving the stuff they like to eat through my sluice, and it's falling out back there, and they're getting free lunch. It's like ringing the dinner bell. And anywhere, the little ones, the smolt, while they're up here, I was real worried about I might be sucking them up. So I was always keeping my hand, shooing them away from the nozzle. But those little fish are smart. They can feel the suction. So them little guys, girls, they stay back far enough away from that suction so they don't get sucked in. It's those plecostomus mud daubers. They're the dumb ones.
on that note, thank you, sir.
Right, I'm done. I had to educate you on that.
I know.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Dean, you'll bring us to closure on this
And mine will be very short and sweet. I won't need 3 minutes. I appreciate the opportunity. I'm Dean Finnerty. I'm the Northwest Director for the Sportsman's Conservation Project for Trout Unlimited. I've been here for the whole entire meeting and have heard the testimony going back and forth. I think that the regulation, the authority question is the first thing that's going to have to be addressed. I think that is pretty compelling, and I think if you were to discount that or for whatever reason find that there wasn't a statutory intent to exclude motorized suction dredge mining in the original law, I think it's pretty clear at minimum the commission should direct the agency to initiate rulemaking. The miners have come forward. They've got some points that they want to make, and I think a rulemaking process is at minimum what needs to occur here to come up with some significant changes that need to occur to the Golden Fish pamphlet. And that's what I wanted to bring up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before I invite staff to come back up, I have one question. What's the biggest nugget you guys have found? Really? You can't tell me?
No, we've actually had...
Then you'll want to come up...
No, I'm just curious. I'm just... Wait, we got one volunteer. What?
I might ask that question. We have a member of our club that got an ounce and a half nugget on a football field. He's the
oh, on a football...
We have members that have brought in 1.1 ounce nuggets. And then okay. You can go and look into YouTube and check out the potato patch, which is a large-scale mining operation in Liberty. He holds a 14 and a 16-ounce nugget in
wow.
his hands.
Pictures don't lie right there.
The largest nugget recorded in Liberty was over 38 pounds.
These were out of the potato patch.
38 oh. Wow. So you're this buying
one,
dinner.
This one right here. This one right here. Yeah, it wasn't mine.
Okay.
This one right here is about 8 ounces, about 2 pounds in that pan.
Oh.
You're the state seal on the Capitol building.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you. Now my curiosity's been met there. So, Jeff, were you come? I was that you guys are coming back up? What? Oh yeah, one quick. Yeah, go on, Commissioner Baker.
Earlier, someone talked.
Jeff,
you were answering Commissioner Thorburn's question, and somebody said that it's actually illegal and punishable by law for a miner to be out prospecting that wasn't in the club that somehow has authority over that area. So hang on. That's so. My question is that just federal ground or is it state ground as well?
Federal and state law for federal trespass. Mining claims can only be established on federal land. It cannot be put on state trust. You can lease the land, but you have to show a profit. And a part of that profit then goes to the state for the education program.
Yeah, I might want to talk to you later or something to learn a little more about that. Thank you.
So, I was just informed that you were to come back up, so I'm not...
I just missed you all.
Likewise.
It's
likewise.
Still respecting, isn't it?
I think the initial intent was we got the petition. You all received the petition before. There was a lot of new faces on the commission that hadn't had the opportunity to be briefed on this in the past, and so today was really about how do we brief you, but do it in a way that's different than we have in the past, where you could hear from the fish conservation organizations, you could hear hopefully from the tribes, and you could hear from the prospectors themselves. So if you're looking for next steps, I think there's a couple in there that I heard loud and clear, the jurisdiction piece. So we'll definitely be following up with the Attorney General's office in that regard. And then I think I personally heard a lot of disagreement about the science, and so I want to talk with my team and some of the folks in the audience here about what we might be able to do about that disagreement of science. I heard a lot about the enforcement side of that, so I want to be able to talk with those same folks and Chief Bear and see if there's opportunities to pursue some alternatives there as well. And then I'd really like to bring back to the commission what the results of those conversations are, to see if you want to take next steps, and if so, what those might look like.
Questions from the commission? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to explore a little bit about what those next steps would be. So we had a petition that was postponed until today, and now we've heard some of this, and we haven't had a discussion about any guidance here, and you're not apparently asking for any today. So if you come back again, could you play this out to an end point as to when the commission in their policy setting capacity would be engaged and to do what?
I will do my best. So point of clarification, the commission rejected the petition. So with the rejection of that petition, you don't have a nudge to do rulemaking, right? And we heard Trout Unlimited request some rulemaking around this. But I also feel like there's an opportunity for us to get to further gain some clarity around some of the issues and that were brought up here today. I heard from Mr. Wilson that he'd like to react to some of the things that the Fish Conservation Panel brought up. So I would really appreciate those things. And then we would bring back kind of here's an update that came out of those conversations and see. You can direct us to do rulemaking or if so I guess what I'm trying to say is I'd like to come back and say, okay, from what we heard today and from additional conversations, here's where we think we are, and just share that with you all. And then you might tell us at that point, okay, given that, initiate rulemaking, or given that, pursue some other non-rulemaking alternatives that might address the issues. And I don't know how you all will feel as a commission, but I feel like I heard some things that I'd like to pursue a little further, so I know I'm doing my job to bring as much clarity to you all as I can.
Commissioner thank you, Jeff and Commissioner McIsaac, for questioning sort of next steps. I think when we denied the petition, it was still with a question that, is the current regulation sufficient? I've heard that you've kind of capsulized the questions. We've heard sort of contrary views of the science and this question about authority. So I totally agree. Next steps, I think we need to look at kind of a timeline. I think that's important because when we had the discussion about next steps, we were sort of looking at a timeline. We want to kind of stay ahead of a curve that's before us, if possible. I don't want to wait too long to kind of see the next steps. Given that information, we may be deciding that we need to take a look at these rules and open them up again.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up in that same vein, you heard some allegations earlier about the state being in clear violation of this or clear violation of that. So when you go back and look at things, some response to all of those things that we heard would be appropriate. Or anything else you heard here today that you feel, if we took all of it at face value, that we might not be getting the full picture from either side. And in terms of coming back, we're about ready to go into some agenda planning that includes a year at a glance, and it's becoming more and more difficult to schedule these matters that can end in a timely manner. So when do you think would be the appropriate time for us to expect to hear back again, so that if the commission did want to do anything or declare that they did not, from a policy perspective, when that might be?
I can't really speak for the Attorney General's office, but the jurisdiction one, I think, is a pretty quick request to the Attorney General for their interpretation, and that may trigger a reaction from you all sooner than later. Mm-hmm. I don't know. You know, we'll put all of our resources on looking into these things, and so it might be that if we can check in with you on a conference call and just keep you abreast of the status, and then we'll work with Tammy about what your agendas look like and how much capacity is within those.
Thanks, guys. Great job. And thank you all for your input. It was most informative and fun, too, so that's good.